side comment that I wanted to make, so let me make it over here. This has to do with the, I just wanted to go back for a second to talk about the Ginsburg criterion and just make one more comment about the starting point. Okay, so you may recall that, so this is, you may recall that the idea for the Ginsburg criterion was that the correlation function, the order parameter, the subtracted one, the fluctuation, the difference in the magnetization from its mean value at one point averaged with that difference at a point that was a correlation length away, that the fluctuations would be relatively unimportant if that was much less than the average magnetization squared. And we then did some little calculation, and we found out that this was some constant times t to the d minus 2 over 2 should be much less than some. So the average magnetization just goes to zero linearly in T as you come up in temperature from below TC. And this correlation function evaluated at the correlation length has this temperature dependence, okay? So the point is that they're both going to zero. Okay, so what I'm plotting here now is m bar squared. And here for the correlation function, I've put in the dimensionality just as a little index here so that we can see what happens. And basically, what m bar squared is doing is that it's going linearly to zero at TC. Now let's just make ourselves a little, that's just TC. Now, what's the correlation function doing? Well, in four dimensions, if D is 4, it's also linear and presumably smaller than m average squared. So this is c tilde 4 of c. And this statement that this is less than that simply says that the criterion is being satisfied. Now what happens as you turn down the dimension in d equals 3, you get something that looks like this. That's going to zero like the square root. And so it's got to be above the this linear curve, m bar squared, at some point. And then if you go to d equals 2, it's just a constant. So it clearly falls above, it lies above m bar squared, and in fact, at some even further from TC. So that's just a picture to go along with what we calculated. Okay, so just you can just sort of incorporate that into your notes. And then another thought that occurred to me. So now, actually, we're going to go on to the Gaussian model. And let me remind you where we left off. Okay, that's where we left off. We had sort of started from some Ising partition function. We looked at the spins within blocks and then developed an effective or an approximate form for the partition function of interacting blocks, where their internal, the internal free energy of a block was like this plus this, and the coupling between blocks would give rise to this. We then made, we then went to a continuum type representation of that rather than working with discrete blocks and obtained this form for the partition function as a functional integral, or I guess you guys would call it a path integral. Okay, so so that was the result. And okay, so I think maybe we should just start from there. So the next question is, how do we calculate this? We've sort of defined it, but now the question is, how do you actually calculate it? Because, you know, many integrals are difficult. This is one of them. And the answer is that we can only do it really in a straightforward way when b is zero. So that's answer one. And when you set b equals zero, that automatically limits you to working above Tc, because if otherwise you have this thing here, if it's a negative coefficient, you're dead. It's unbounded negative. But nevertheless, by calculating this partition function above Tc, we can learn interesting new things about the nature of the transition with the kinds of fluctuations incorporated in the partition function that arise because of these interblock couplings, this gradient squared piece. So it's worth doing. I should say, when I say we can't do this, I mean, we don't have a method yet for doing this. I mean, in a sense, when you get to the renormalization group theory, you successively do this integral by doing short wavelength or short distance stuff first, and then rescaling and going on. So you eventually do it. But right now, we don't know how to do this integral, but we can do it when b is 0. OK, so who's first here? Yes. Yeah, what did I say? Sorry. Yeah, thanks. Yes. OK. So was that your question? Yeah, the other one is. So I'm not quite okay. So if t is greater than tc, so that this coefficient is positive, then the potential part of the free energy looks like as plotted versus m looks like that, right? And both terms are happy, are consistent with that. They both make it go up, okay? So if t is less than tc, on the other hand, this term here is so this is what happens when t is less than tc, it's going down. And if b is 0, you don't have this thing to pull it back up. So the free energy is unbounded from below. So I don't know. Is that the answer? Yeah, OK. So so the point is that we can do this calculation when b is 0. It only applies to the case where t is greater than tc. It's going to give us new information about how things, what happens as t goes to tc from above. It's still going to be wrong when you get very close to tc, because when you get very close to tc, this thing becomes very flat, and this then starts to enter into the low energy fluctuations. And so you won't quite get things right. But you will get some, you will get a better result, in other words, a more accurate result than we got just from mean field theory, because of the fact that we'll be including all of these spatial fluctuations in the order parameter in our calculation of thermodynamic quantities. So so this is a step towards finding a more correct answer for t greater than tc. So then, let's go back to this question. How do we calculate this? The second thing is we use Fourier transform fields. By fields, I mean these m's. So so for instance, rho integral where this is the Fourier transform of M of R. And it goes over to Same thing with the q squared out in front. Where these q's are discrete for finite volume, but we'll be interested in the limit volume goes to infinity. So then, the partition function in terms of these variables becomes So let's see. So what have we got up here? So we integrate over all of these Fourier coefficients, m of q, from minus infinity to plus infinity. Everything here is multiplying m of q squared. So this is just some product of Gaussian integrals. Now, let me just go through a look at a couple of the details about how you do this calculation, just so that we get our counting right. So, although the M of R's are real, the M of Q, the Fourier coefficients, because basically these things are sum over sites of, or sum over, or integral over space of M of R with an e to the IQ dot R. Yes. Yeah, I did. Sorry, I got to another too many halves. Let's get rid of, yeah, that's just a mistake. Not what I had in my notes. Okay. Okay, so the point is that these are complex. However, because of the fact that M of R is real, then M of Q of minus Q is M of Q star. Yeah. Yeah, right. That's what I, that's, okay. Because M is real, yeah. It's, that's why that is. So the point is that although these are complex numbers, they're only independent for half of the q's, if you like. Okay, because, I mean, we started out with a single number for every r, and here we have two numbers for every q. So these things are only independent. They're not independent because of this. Okay, so... And you have some flexibility as to how you're going to do that. So let me write the partition function this way. as and then I'm somewhat arbitrarily going to be saying that this is QZ positive, say. That's what this prime means. And then I have dm of q, dm of minus q, and then we've got this integral again, summing over half the q's. Same thing. Where that's right. And so basically, I apologize for going ponderously through all of these steps, but in the end, then it's just, the answer just falls out. I mean, it probably would anyway, if you did it in some more. So we look at one factor here, one factor in the sum, because it's just a bunch of independent factors. It's equal to minus infinity to infinity dm prime q integral from minus infinity to infinity dm double prime q. This thing here, e to the minus beta did I drop a 2? Yeah, but I think you're right. Okay, let's put it in, because it looks like it should be there. And here what we've got is m prime of q squared plus m double prime of q squared. And that's just equal to, yeah, 2 because, right, I think you're right. Yeah, okay, yeah, that's what I was worried. I think it is without the 2 because, yeah, I think that's exactly right. Okay, good. So that's gone. Okay, thank you. Thanks. And then this is just simple. Then this is just equal to pi. It's like two Gaussian integrals. Beta a prime t minus tc plus this other thing, k c naught squared q squared. Okay. So that's the answer there. And then we can put it back, then put this back into here. And the whole partition function. And now I can take an unrestricted product over Q's, and I'm going to compensate that for that by just taking the square root of this expression. Okay. And then we're set. That's the answer. Okay. So that's the partition function. For t above tc, if you neglect this quartic term, which is less important above tc than it is below tc. So now we can go ahead and calculate everything. So we've got f, little f, is minus t over n, the log of z. Which is t over 2n, let's raise this up a little bit, sum over q, log of this thing, minus some constant factor from the pi. So what have we got here? This 2 comes from the fact that they're all square roots. Then that's it. That's the free energy per site. Okay. The internal energy which can be written as d beta f d beta, this per site again, is 1 over 2n let's see, when we multiply by the beta we get rid of this t out in front, so all the t's are the in terms of the in here, where are their t's, there's this guy and there's this guy, and there's a this becomes a constant because when we multiply by beta, it's just log pi, so that's going to go away. Okay, so we've got 1 over 2n, sum over q, t well, let me just write it down and then we'll just figure it out. A prime t squared over a prime times t minus tc plus k c naught squared q squared. So let's see. There's that. I'm just worried about a minus sign. Now that one's right. Beta. Okay, so when I take the log of beta, that's minus the log of t. No, so it's log of 1 over t minus. Oh, I see. Yeah. No, I don't. D beta. So I'm doing. Beta, which is 1 over t. I'm just differentiating with respect to beta, which is 1 over t. D beta. What are you worried about? Partial versus regular, or what? Okay, so that's minus. I'm just worried about. Minus log t d beta. Yeah, I think it's right. Yeah, minus log t. Yeah, so this is, let's see, d beta of log beta is 1 over beta. Yeah, okay, right. Yeah, that's pretty simple. Right, okay. So that's the t. And then the rest comes from differentiating this guy, 1 over that times the things that are multiplying it. Bd beta rather than d by dt, yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. Okay, so is everyone, now that I'm comfortable with this, is that anyone else? Everyone else? Okay, maybe we should push, yeah. Oh, well, because I'm thinking initially of finite volume, and then the limit is the volume goes to infinity. So if you have finite volume, then your Fourier, you have a sum over Qs, right? Because they're spaced by 1 over the length scale.
So you mean the discrete Fourier form is due to the finite.
If the volume is finite, then you have a discrete sum. You have a sum over Qs, and then
the thing has something to do with the lattice structure.
No. We've sort of taken out the lattice structure, and first of all, we started with a lattice. We turned it into blocks. We defined these magnetizations on blocks, and then we sort of took a continuum limit. And what I said, I think, in the last lecture was you should just think of M of R as interpolating from block to block. Okay, so R is a continuous variable, which means that the Q here, I guess, so the spacing between, you know, that's gone to, so Q in principle can go to infinity, I guess, but it's still a sum. Okay. I'm sort of working in, in order to make the interpretation of this functional integral, easier to think about, I'm sort of effectively working with finite volume on a lattice, and then in the end I take the limit, you know, lattice constant goes to zero, size of the system goes to infinity, keeping your constant density of degrees of freedom. So it's just, I guess that's just the way condensed matter physicists like to think. So, so where are we here? So, last step is the specific heat. is just the temperature derivative of the internal energy, which is what we calculated there. And here you've got temperatures in two places, one in the numerator and one in the denominator. And, well, you've got temperatures in three places, actually. You've got a temperature out here, which is going to give you a constant term. You've got temperature up here, and you've got temperature down here. And at this point, we're just going to focus in on the one that's going to give us the most singular specific heat, or singular heat capacity. Okay, so we can write this. Basically, I'm going to do the derivative with respect to this guy down here. Plus less singular terms. Okay, so the less singular terms are the constant that you get from differentiating the first t, and the thing that you get if you differentiate the t squared up in the numerator, which just has a 1 over this thing with the q squared in it, whereas this one has 1 over that squared. If you do it right. So when I say less singular, I mean when t goes to tc, then this is going to have a 1 over q to the fourth. Okay, so that's what I mean by singular in the region of q0, which is the long wavelength contributions to this sum. Okay, so that's where the divergences are going to come from. So at this point, we're going to define a temperature-dependent correlation length slightly differently. Because if you like, we put in a little bit of extra detail into this free energy in terms of the coefficients that we've been using. But bottom line is the same. There's some correlation length, which is multiplying, effectively multiplying q squared. And so if you use this definition, then C, the so-called singular part of C, is bring out some factors. I'm going to turn the sum into an integral. So that's the d-dimensional q-space integral. And then there's an angular integral and so forth, which you can take out, which I'll call alpha d. That's the angular integral. We've got 2 and 2 pi to the d. 1 over rho. I think we've defined rho as n over d. there's a factor out front, t squared over t minus tc squared. And then we have some integral, which I'll write as 0 to q max, q to the d minus 1 dq over 1 plus c squared q squared squared. Okay, I put this in because we're not exactly sure how this integral is going to converge at its upper limit. That depends on the dimensionality. Okay, but in the end, we'd like to take qmax to infinity. Or we'd like to be able to. So how do we do this? So let's start out by going to dimensionless variable, scaling out the temperature dependence like that. And we'll also note that we already have t squared over t minus tc squared, which we could have written as c to the fourth times a bunch of constants, a prime squared over k, c naught squared, squared, t squared. When I say constants, I mean t now, is basically going to be tc, because we're only looking now in the vicinity of tc. So then this integral of q to the d minus 1 dq over 1 plus c squared q squared squared is going to be c to the minus d times an integral where the upper limit depends on the correlation length now because of that. X to the d minus 1 dx over 1 plus x squared squared. And so then the whole specific heat, what have we got here? We've got a factor of c to the fourth, and we've got a factor of c to the minus d from this integral. And so then the whole is a bunch of constants, alpha d over 2 times 2 pi to the d rho. So we're starting to have a chalk crisis here, by the way. Notice this building up over the last several days. need to refresh. Okay, so that's the answer. And so how do we interpret that? Okay. So as C goes to infinity, there are three different cases. Okay. So one case is D less than 4. If D is less than 4, then that integral converges. The upper limit goes to infinity as C goes to infinity, and you just get a number. Okay, because it's basically got x to the fourth in the denominator. So C singular goes like C to the 4 minus D. And that implies that alpha, the specific heat exponent, because remember C is going like 1 over the square root, is equal to 4 minus D over 2. Wonderful. So that's neat because that's actually a new exponent. We didn't have that before. We didn't get that out of mean field theory, Ruben.
So the integral converges for d smaller than 4?
Right.
But for d smaller than 4, the exponent of psi is positive?
That's right. So that means this diverges.
Oh, there's the other side. Sure. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, because it's got to, t minus t to the minus mu. Okay, let me just repeat that. So we have a new exponent that we didn't have before. Remember, in mean field theory, alpha is just 0. And so this is like extra information coming out of the fact that we've allowed these Gaussian fluctuations to be incorporated into the partition function above Tc. Okay, so that's a new result. Then if we look at D equals 4, then C so what happens when D equals 4? Well, the factor out in front is just a constant, but that integral is logarithmically divergent in the ultraviolet, in other words, because of the top limit. So you've got 1 over x basically, as the integrand, the integral goes to infinity. So that goes like the log of C Q max. Okay, so that's that. So this now depends on the cutoff. In other words, you know, going 100 steps back to the starting point, that would be, say, the lattice constant or the block size or some small number. But the bottom line is it's a logarithm, and it's going like the log of the correlation length. So this corresponds to alpha equals 0, which is totally consistent with. But it shows you another way that alpha can be 0, because remember, in mean field theory, alpha is, you know, there's just a specific heat jump, and we call that alpha equals 0. But here it's a log. And so that's a little bit different. Actually, a bit more, I mean, these logs do pop up in nature. Now for greater than 4, then the integral diverges like, let's see, I'll write it down and then you can check this. C Qmax to the 4 D minus 4. Yeah, that's right, because you've got x to the d minus 1 over x to the 4th is x to the d minus 5, and you do the integral, you get x to the d minus 4. The contribution, the largest contribution is from the upper limit. And the point is that that cancels with the prefactor, right? We already have a factor of c to the 4 minus d out in front. So basically, that just gives us a constant. For higher dimension. Does everybody see that? And it depends on the short length physics, but it's a constant in temperature. Okay, so so we can look at this in a little bit more detail and recover it's like an alternative derivation of the Ginzburg criterion. I mean, the Ginzburg criterion that we derived before, we did by looking at what happens as T approaches TC from below. And now we can use this to look at how things behave as T goes to TC from above. Okay? So, alternative derivation. In mean field theory, there's a specific heat jump, which I think in the if you formulate this, yeah.
According to my understanding, the Ginzburg criterion was the use of mean field theory in order to ascertain under what conditions mean field theory is an accurate description?
That's how we did it below TC, but the Ginzburg criterion is actually a criterion for the width of the critical region. That's what we got out of that. This, what you're saying is how we did it. So now here we have another way of doing it, which basically is going to compare the mean field result to a result that's calculated from a better theory, which includes more fluctuations. And the question is when does the contribution from those fluctuations become large compared to what mean field theory gives you? And I mean, qualitatively, I'll show you that in a second with a picture.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, that's...
I just thought that when we introduced the Ginzburg criteria...
That's what we said, yeah.
That it was used to ascertain under what conditions mean field theory is an accurate description.
Well, that's right, yes. So there we did it by using internal consistency. And here we're going to answer the same question to in what regime is mean field theory accurate or where does it break down? By instead of looking just at internal consistency, we're going to look at the comparison of the mean field result to a somewhat more accurate result.
Okay.
Okay, and this will extend the argument which was down here to above TC. Okay, that's the idea. So it's not just completely an alternative, you know, it's like you could use this or that. I mean, it actually is focusing on slightly different information. That's true. Okay, so what do we have? I think in this notation, delta C would be something like this is specific heat jump. And please don't ask me about factors of two at this point. The singular part of the free energy that we just calculated looks like that. So the fluctuation regime actually, let me just jump ahead and draw the picture here. This is the mean field result, that the specific heat is zero above TC, and then it jumps to this value, delta C. And this is the result of the Gaussian model. And then if we did the calculation below TC, there'd be something like that, but we haven't done that calculation. But the point is that there's some region here where at least above TC, the contributions of the Gaussian fluctuations to the specific heat are large, become larger than the specific heat jump. And so this is the critical region. And this picture is appropriate for D equals 3. And also, this C naught here basically, if you use the results of that calculation, it looks something like this: A prime T squared over K C naught squared. Okay, C naught squared over A prime T to the 4 minus p over 2 basically goes like so what have I got to the 4th? That cancels out c naught squared to the minus d over 2, or c naught to the minus, let's see, 3/16. OK, I better be more careful here. C naught to the 4th, c naught to the 4 minus d. OK, now let's try that again. C naught to the 4th, c naught to the 4 minus d, the 4's cancel, you get c naught squared to the minus d. Right, OK. So the point is that this is the same dependence, this amplitude here, that would say that the critical region, or this specific heat exponent, depends on the 1 over the 6th power of the correlation length in 3 dimensions. OK, so I mean, everything comes out. Is this OK?
My only question is, psi naught was the size of a block, let's say.
Right.
Now, I mean, I understand it's a length, and the correlation length is also a length.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I see your point.
And again, here we call this the time dependent correlation length, but.
Temperature-dependent
correlation length. But again, does this have to be the correlation length? Is it?
Yeah, because you could go back and calculate the correlation function and for this theory. It would have the same square root of 1 over t minus tc behavior.
Okay.
So yeah, no, it's definitely the same correlation. OK, so I agree. Maybe this, I mean, dimensionally, this comes out right. This result should be consistent with what we did just using the looking below TC. But the bottom line is that that this critical region is determined by when the contribution due to Gaussian fluctuations becomes large compared to the mean field contribution. Interestingly,
when you do mean field theory, you study the t below tc case, and for the Gaussian model, study the t above tc case. Right?
Well, for mean field theory, remember we have results all the way. The specific heat looks like zero. You calculated this, I think. In the tutorial, it's zero above TC, and it jumps and is to delta C below TC. So in mean field theory, you can calculate the specific heat above and below TC. In the Gaussian model, because you can only calculate above TC.
And do you assume that? Yes, I was thinking, what is the meaning of the dashed line?
This one here, it's just telling you what would happen if you could do the calculation below TC, but we haven't done that calculation.
So you simply apply the result of the Gaussian model in above TC to the below TC.
Right. I mean, you could just say the critical region above TC is this. OK? You know, how close do you have to get? Just like we did there, we said, how close do you have to get to TC from below before the fluctuations are important compared to the mean field result. Here you could do the same thing and say, how close do you have to get to TC from above? And that gives you the width of the critical region. And actually, and they agree. I mean, you know, they're the same. The criterion that comes from the calculation below TC is the same as what comes from the calculation above TC for the Gaussian model. So it's all, it all hangs together. So there's just two more things that I wanted to say, which is that in the context of the scaling theory, we can also express this in terms of the thermal exponent, which you may recall appeared in, say, Kadanoff's length scaling theory and will appear in, you know, argument theory and so forth. And so this so 2 minus alpha is 2 minus 2 plus d over 2 is equal to d over y sub t. So that says that the thermal exponent is 2. That's a big relevant exponent. And that's pretty much it. Yeah.
For the calculation for C naught, it should be psi naught to the power of minus d, not psi squared. Oh. Yeah. Extra factor of 2.
Force cancels. Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah.
I don't know. Does this affect the result?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I need to think about this a little bit more.
So that's the result. Is that
yeah,
the result?
I think this is the result, but I have to admit it's not. It's not obvious how it comes out of this. Okay, so I need to think about it.
Okay. So you're saying what you've written on?
Yeah, actually, what I have in my notes here is this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, but this is for C naught, not the width of the critical region. Yeah, okay, let me think about that. I mean, I think all the algebra here, now that we've corrected that mistake, is correct. And the interpretation in terms of how the width of the critical region depends on the C naught, or K for that matter, I should probably just think that a little more. Yeah, Rupert.
So we say the Gaussian model is better than the mean field theory, which I understand because it has fluctuations incorporated.
Right.
But on the other hand, mean field theory is capable of treating B non-zero.
Right.
So it's not. Is it obvious that from what we've calculated that it's necessarily better than?
Well, okay. So then it becomes a question of what you mean by better. Yeah, it's better for this. It's better for calculating the contributions of the fluctuations to the specific heat above some C. But you're right.
So if you would calculate the same results with B non-zero, you would the results would not, these results that we used would not be modified.
No, you would get a different exponent.
But not to
the alpha that you would get if you put B not equal to zero.
But would it be changed dramatically or?
Oh, dramatically?
Because we assume it's better than the mean field theory calculation. So.
Yeah, so I think what I would say is that if you put the B in, you then have this what I would call the full problem. What's going to happen, say, to the heat capacity as you come down? It'll look mean field like out here, which is just say that it's small. It will start to come up with this, and then it will sort of then when you get into the truly critical region, the actual exponent by which it diverges will not be 4 minus L, 4 minus V over 2. It'll be something different. And so, you know, if you put the rest of the ingredients in, you get the exact answer. And actually, it's really neat to see how that comes out of the renormalization group theory. Because there is a fixed point in the RG flow diagram that corresponds to this Gaussian fixed point, but then there's another one that tells you what really happens when you get close. So that will come out in the theory, yes.
So we have an expression for C0 that comes from the Gaussian model, and we have an expression for delta C from mean field theory. And we have the Ginsburg criterion, that's that inequality that involves both C0 and delta C.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to combine the results of mean theory and this C0 result of the Gaussian model in order to see in what regime the Ginsburg criterion is satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, well, yes and no. I mean, so it all depends on whether things are symmetrical around TC, which so far I guess we don't really know. Right. So we've made an estimate of the width below TC. We've made an estimate of the width above TC. In terms of power laws and, you know, how they depend on dimensionality, they agree.
Sorry, this is probably an extremely naive question, but I don't see an expression for the width above TC.
Oh, it's when this curve rises above delta C. So if you solve this for T.
Right. So in order to do that, I'm just saying that we substitute in the C0 from the Gaussian model and the delta C from the mean field theory. So we combine from two different theories into one inequality to solve for the width above.
Right, because the criterion is comparing the two theories. But I mean, you know, the T is going to go like something to the 2 over D minus 4. Okay, any other questions? We'll start RG tomorrow.